All right, welcome everyone. My name is Dolores Mast. I'm from Whiteville, Tennessee. And I've taught, my teaching experience is a little different probably than most people's, in which I have taught all grades. Right now I'm teaching first grade. It's kind of where I've landed right now, and also special ed. It's not what I always do. I think there's great things about each stage. Some people ask me, well, what do you prefer to teach? Probably it would be middle grades, but I love things about first grade. I love things about high school. And I don't know, there's just fun things about every stage. Having said that, the school I'm teaching in right now, we seem to have a lot of students that are struggling with reading. And as we know, dyslexia tends to be genetic. And I think it's kind of like if you had, you know, a family, you might have weak lungs or weak heart or something like that. Well, if you had weak lungs, if you had a family history of having weak lungs, you probably wouldn't, you would probably do things to prevent your lungs from getting worse, right? You might have air purifiers and things like that. My interest lies in seeing what we can do to prevent dyslexia. Now, I'm going to use the term, I'm going to define what I'm going to talk about as dyslexia here, because I think we throw that term around so much, and it's kind of hard to know what somebody's talking about when they say, use the term dyslexia. But I came across a quote in the last year that said, dyslexia cannot be cured, it can only be prevented. And I have tried to find that quote, and I haven't been able to find it. But that's where my interest lies, and I'll be honest with you. Yeah, raise your hand if you need
raise
them high. Oh, wow.
I need one, Mr. Miller.
Sure thing, Miss Katie. Is there
another
one?
He was
down?
My teacher, by the way.
He's mine, too.
Okay, keep your hands up, please. 15 or 40.
Thank you. So going back to what I was saying, my interest lies in trying to see what we can do to prevent dyslexia. And so I have a lot of ideas. I'll be honest with you, it feels like some of these things we're just kind of stumbling or just at the place we're almost finding some answers. And I'm excited to know what the next 10 years is going to do in the world of phonics and some of that. But I'll just go ahead and share with you some of the things I've come across. And I do want to say, if what you are doing is working and you're not having any problems, keep on doing what you're doing. I'm not here to say this and this and this is the way you should teach. However, what I'm bringing is, if you have problems, here are some things that you can look at to see if you can find what the problems. It's kind of like having a car and it quits working, and yet, you know, I'm not a mechanic. I have no idea which little part here is not working correctly. And if I take it to a mechanic, he understands how a car works, and he would be able to, you know, diagnose the car, whatever you want to say. I'm just kind of bringing to you some things to consider, and you might be picturing your own students and saying, maybe that's the problem, or maybe this is the problem, and you might have to try two or three things. I have this quote here. John Steinbeck, the author of Mice and Men, says, some people, there are, who, being grown, forget the horrible task of learning to read. It is perhaps the greatest single effort that a human undertakes, and he must do it as a child. I'm sorry, I underestimated the attendance here quite. Back to this quote. By reading this quote, what do you think, what would be your, would this give you any clue to Steinbeck's school experience? We might even say, I wonder if he's dyslexic. I don't know. I actually haven't looked up his story or anything like that. But it's a good, there's a good chance that he did have dyslexia. I don't know, because many very intelligent people do. You know, Albert Einstein, Henry Ford, George Washington. We go on and on, and we look at these people in history, and we say, there's probably a good chance they have those signs. The term dyslexia, this comes from a Congress act of the First Step Act from 2018. The term dyslexia means an unexpected difficulty in reading for an individual who has the intelligence to be a much better reader, most commonly caused by a difficulty of phonological processing, which is the appreciation of the individual sounds of a spoken language, which affects the ability of an individual to speak, read, and spell. So I am going to use the term dyslexia as simply you're not reading on your grade level. I'm not just going to talk about dyslexia, but that is probably our most common reading problem. Nancy Young has a very nice graphic that shows the different steps of, I guess, population and where they fall in. So about 5 to 10% of children learn to read almost without an effort. We've probably seen a few of those around. I know of a little girl who was reading, you know, we all know that there's children who read before they go to school. And this child was reading before she came to school. And I was like, well, you know, what is she reading? And her aunt said, well, she comes to my house most times. She'll try to read anything. But if she really wants to read something she enjoys, she'll be reading The Boxcar Children or Anne of Green Gables. And this is before the child ever learned school or ever went to school. There are those children that they just pick it up. There is about 35 to 40%. It takes a little bit of effort, a little bit of teaching, but it's pretty minimal. Somehow I feel like too many of our phonics programs hit these two upper levels. So we're looking at anywhere from, you know, 40 to 50%. It doesn't take, we go down to 40 to 45% of the people. We really need to teach them. We need to teach them explicitly. They need a lot of practice. They need to be taught this is what happens. They won't just catch on their own. And then we have the bottom tier that would, it takes not only explicit, it's extensive and lots of review. You probably need to have some one-on-one or some extra help with this. However, I personally think that our teaching should probably hit that 40 to 45% where we are teaching very explicitly, very well. I know there's the concern that the first two levels, those people are going to get bored. how do you keep students, some of you teachers who've taught for years, what are some things that you do to keep some of those that just learn without trying? How do you keep them from being bored? I'd like to hear from you.
Give them extra work.
Give them extra work?
Or something else.
Okay.
Are you talking just about first graders or others?
Probably anyone.
Mm-hmm. I think when you teach it a large variety of methods, that can help keep it interesting. If you're using sand and hand motions and singing and chanting, that's going to help too.
Mm-hmm. That was my thought. So this child that I was talking about that was reading Anne of Green Gables before she ever went to school, her aunt told me, she'll be fine in school. She'll think this is all great. She might know it all, but she just thinks it's cool to be in school. We can make our classrooms, like Aaron Durstein was talking about it, make it play. And hey, even if they do know those things, they will, they'll be able to, yeah. I think good teachers can spice up their teaching and keep teaching from being boring. Do we have handouts for everyone now? Is there anybody that doesn't have a handout? Okay. I set this in just last minute here. This is the technical Star Wars reading rope in which we talk about all the different strands of what it takes to have reading. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this. This is something I just want to give you as reference. Here is what the professionals say it takes, and I think they've done a very good job in thinking about what all does it take to read. We know reading is a very complex skill. We don't think about how complex it is because probably for most of us, reading came naturally, or not naturally, but we probably, yeah, some of you may have struggled, and if you did, that gives you an advantage because you know firsthand what didn't make sense for you. But sometimes it's kind of like riding a bike. Sometimes you have to break it down. You just do it, and you have to break it down and say, well, what does it take to learn to read? So I came up with my own levels here, or my own, I don't know, levels is probably not a good word for it, but different parts of learning to read. And I'm going to talk about each of these a little bit. So this was put together by myself. It's not backed by any professional or anything. So. First thing I'm going to talk about, though, is one that I think, yeah, it's kind of a breakthrough that we are learning, and that is phonemic awareness. How many of you teach Hegarty in your classrooms? Okay. This is something that some of you may want to look at. It is a 10-minute more or less, exercise every day for, I think there's, how many weeks is there? It's not quite to the end of 30 weeks, so it's not quite to the end of school. If I have a part week, most times I don't finish out the week, I just keep it on the weeks. I have skipped weeks the first year I used it. I did not start at the beginning of the year, so I skipped weeks, but it is just a very easy thing to teach, and it makes a big difference. So phonological awareness or phonemic awareness is simply the taking the sounds and the awareness that words are put together by sounds. Being able to take that word and break up break it up into individual sounds. So I'm going to, I've got a definition here in just a little bit. I will say that very often, especially if it's just typical dyslexia, this may be what is missing. And so if you just go ahead and add it to all your students, it's going to help. It's probably going to help tremendously. So I have a definition here by Jan Hasbrock. She writes Conquering Dyslexia. I have a couple books here. One is Overcoming Dyslexia. How many of you have read this book? A few of you? It takes a while. It is a very fascinating book. But if you need something that's just going to be a little easier to read and a little faster, this is a very good book as well. But she defines phonemic awareness as successful decoding. She says, successful decoding depends on the reader's brain ability to notice, identify, and ultimately manipulate the sounds of spoken words. So you're breaking words apart into sounds. And this also includes phoneme isolation. A phoneme is a sound. So phoneme isolation, blending them, segmenting, adding, deleting, and substituting. And you have all that here in your Hegarty. It starts out, it's very easy to do. They start out with syllables and then sounds, and you simply just follow. It's no prep, except at the beginning I usually like to, there are YouTube videos to show you how to teach it, and so I'll try to make sure I know how to do the hand motions that go with it. Anyway, I don't want to say too much there, I'll run out of time, but if you have any more questions, feel free. I'm going to put these things over here. There's also, Hegarty also has something called Bridge the Gap. If you're just working with one student, you need to know what their problem is. This is another option. They both are from Hegarty. And there's a website on the back page there. Those of you who teach Christian Light, learning to read, you have something called Blending Fun. Other curriculums may have something else. I don't know what it's called. That is your phonemic awareness. However, it's a good chance it's not quite enough. So I use Hegarty. It's approximately 10 minutes a day, and I use it for most of the year. All right, learning phonemes are learning the sounds. Going on to the next thing. Don't skimp on this. Even if your class comes in, it seems like they know their sounds well. Still, I like to make a big deal about, a pretty big deal about a new sound. Do something special. I know teachers are busy, you can't do everything, but so don't put yourself on a guilt trip if you don't get everything done, but try as much as you have time for to kind of make a big deal about the sounds as you learn them. And those of you who are teaching second, third grade, I encourage you to review some of the harder sounds. We talk a lot about the voiced and unvoiced, and I guess that came up in music in choir. I wasn't out there, but yeah, thinking about, does this sound use your voice box? And we often say it out loud and hold our hands up to our necks. Are we using our voice box? Are we not using our voice box? Our voice. I'm talking about the position of the tongue, where how do you say that? I mean, we say t all the time, but do you really think about what does your tongue do when you say t? Get them to say it out loud. And I know sometimes you have more than one grade and well, you know, there's more important things than a completely quiet classroom. I think it's good to go ahead and have them say it out loud and experience it. Also, there is such a thing as a vowel valley. If you have a problem with the different vowels, like the F and the E, U-Fly, you can get this online, University of Florida Literacy Institute. Go on there. There's lots of things on that website, but they have pictures of this, the tongue, mouth position. If you have problems and you want to show that, I think I'm going to use a vowel valley this year, where it shows how the position of your mouth is different for each of the vowels, breaking these things apart. These things that we do all the time, we don't even think about. Try to make your sounds as clean as possible. Do not say buh. Do not say duh. Buh, duh. There are a few that are really, really hard. One is the NG. Some people will say you can't use that. You can't say that without putting a vowel to it. So it's ang, ing, ong. It is possible. I spent 6 years in Kenya, and there are a few words that start with that sound. And I always like to tell my students that, you know, in Swahili, the word for cow is ng'ombe. And when I first tried to say that, I just couldn't get my mouth to say that. But it's just because of our American vowels. It is possible. However, if you want to put a vowel to it, it is easier. The R. How do you teach the R sound?
Ruh.
You say ruh.
I told them to start saying rabbit, but then stop.
So it becomes. And so what's the difference between that and the R?
You had an E on the front or something.
So I tried this year. I thought I was doing a really good job and making it very clean. And I would tell them it's not R, it's R. It's I can't even do it now. And it just wasn't working. They were just saying R. And somebody told me that she started saying R. And I know you have an behind that. But I think it's actually, I think that's kind of what you're saying too. Like it's actually better to say, to put the schwa or the sound behind it in this case than in front of it. Because, yeah, we don't want them to get that mixed up with the schwa R. That one's really difficult. And then I realized that the Y is actually the same way. If you really think about it, you probably say yeah. In that case, you are saying behind the two. And I just decided, you know what? Some things just have to be that way. If you come up with a way, I love to hear it. But that's where I've come to. All right, going on to blending. I like to use objects. Just came from Bing's class, and he was talking about using objects to help with learning to read and things like that. And I think that's a very good thing. I was wishing, again, this comes from, if you go on UFly, there is a folder, and I was wanting to make one, and I decided I didn't have enough time. But there's use a file folder, and you can print out all the letters. Instead of having magnets, like those of you who are familiar with Barton, you have all the magnets and everything. There you just take paper, and you have little squares with all the letters, and Velcro. And you have it on a file folder. Maybe I can just show you here quickly. Oh, no, I can't. I'm sorry, I thought I had it up, and I don't. But you can take those those tiles, those paper tiles, and make words out of it, and they can have their own set. And I think that's a really good way to move letters around, things like that. Blending, sometimes I like to use a slide, picture of a slide, but there are, that's easier for sounds like where you can continue to make it, but a sound like d or g, I like to use something more like a frog, and you jump over onto the next sound. So, yeah, la, versus ma, and like that. You probably can get by with using a slide for both of them too, but just something to keep in mind. Don't skimp on sounding out words. Make sure you really drill in this stage. And I like to think of decoding and encoding at the same time. And what I mean by that is reading and spelling. If you can spell, you can probably read. So go ahead and do them both at the same time. Now, you don't have to spell on paper every time, although I would encourage you to do some of that. I like to have tablets. They get out, and they, at least spell pretty much every day. There's other ways to spell. Like I said, like that file folder I was just telling you about where they move their little papers around. You can use sand. Shaving cream works, too, if you want to have it all smell really strong. Sometimes if you really want to be messy, you could use something like chocolate pudding or something. Some love it, some hate it. It's hilarious. Irregular words. So let's look at this irregular word. Well, let me start it off saying the word is said. Repeat it after me.
Said.
Okay, so let's break apart the word said. Now I'm going to fingerspell. You start with your non-writing hand. Probably most of you is going to be your left hand. I'm going to be doing it opposite of you. And we're going to break it apart and figure out how many sounds we have in the word said. So again, repeat it after me.
Said.
Let's do it together.
Said.
Okay, so what was the first sound? Okay, how do you spell the s sound? S, okay. What's the next sound?
Eh.
How do you spell the eh sound?
E.
Okay, short E. And the next one?
D.
And how's, what's that letter?
D.
D, thank you. Now, this is not the way the word said is spelled. There is a part in here, this N sound is actually spelled not E, but A-I. I don't know why it's like that, but for some reason, the F sound is spelled A-I. So you're going to have to learn this part by heart. You're just going to have to know it. So we're going to put a heart around the AI because you need to know that by heart. Now, by teaching it this way, there are three sounds, and how many sounds have to be learned by memory? Oh, just one, okay? So, you ever had a child with an irregular word, and it might be the word who, and they say, well, no, let me try it. Let's think of the word said, and they say was. Ever had that happen? I mean, it's not anywhere to that. They're just guessing. This keeps some of the guessing out of it. Try to sound out as much of the word as we can. Because here, we have two sounds that make the sound that you would expect. All we have to remember is this sound. And then we say, we have to learn that by heart. You can use anything else. You can who's a star or whatever. But so I would encourage you to look at even your irregular words and try as much as you can to explain what each letter, what sounds they make. And children pick up on that. And they know that, oh, well, you know, sometimes if you know the source of a word, you can kind of say, well, this word comes from the French, and that's why it's spelled this way, or whatever. But sometimes you just say, I don't know why. A lot of times you say, I don't know why. Syllabication is the skill of taking a multi-syllable word and dividing it up into syllables, being able to figure out where those syllables should be divided and what each of those, what sounds are made in each of those syllables. Every syllable has a vowel sound. So you have at least one vowel in every syllable. How many of you teach the six or seven, whatever you want to call it, different syllable types? How many of you teach that? Does anybody teach that? You do? Mm-hmm. Do you teach it? Is it in your curriculum, or do you just add it to it?
I add it if I get around to teaching it.
Okay. Yeah, we all know that. All know what that's like. I came across something that said that there's not a lot of evidence that teaching the different syllables and the etymology, which is the history of words, actually makes a big difference in skillful readers. However, I find it makes things make sense to me. So I tend to teach it that way. So I'm just telling you, there's not like a lot of studies that say, yes, you do it this way, you get skillful readers, but it does make sense to me. First of all, we have the open and closed syllable, and I'm just going to take that together. And let's look at the word open. How many vowels do we have in that word?
Two.
Okay. So we have O and we have E. Now, we're going to divide. This is going to be one syllable, and this is another. We have how many consonants between the two syllables?
One.
Normally, it goes to the back. If there's one consonant, normally it goes to the back. Not always. Most times it goes to the back. So let's try that and see. Now, in that case, O becomes an open syllable because there is no consonant closing it off. You can actually go on for Teachers Pay Teachers. I think there's some cool graphics about with an open and closed door. The closed door has a consonant on it. So if the syllable is open, it means the vowel is long. If it is closed, it has a consonant behind it, it means the vowel is short. So in this case, this would be long or short?
Long.
Okay, so we have O, and then this would be long or short?
Short,
because it's closed off. So let's just try this open. Is that a word you know? Okay, we can stop there. If it wasn't a word you know, we'd have to, you know, decide. Okay, let's. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah.
Those are the two most common. Of course, we have the silent E. I usually like to talk about the magic E that taps the vowel on the head and then he says its name. It's great if you have like a wand or something. You have the R-controlled syllables, the R, the OR, the ER, all those. Also talk about the bossy R. You know, you have a friend who's really bossy and he makes you do things that you wouldn't normally do. That's the R. He makes the vowels do things they don't say things they normally wouldn't say. So it's the bossy R. You have the vowel team. This also includes the diphthongs like oi, ow, those. And then the consonant LE is fun. Look at the word table. Well, Let's break it up first. Table. How many sounds, how many syllables do you have in the word table?
Two.
Okay. So say it together.
Table.
Let's break it up.
Table.
All right. The first one, how many sounds?
Two.
A. All right. And then what's the last one?
Boo.
What's the vowel sound of that?
Schwa.
Schwa. So it should be the U, right? But the U says, uh-uh. I'm not in there. It's so quick. It's so fast. You about don't hear him. And the U says, no, I'm not there. And he refuses to go there. But we know that every vowel needs a syllable, right? So good old E. He says, he just makes peace. And he says, okay, I'll do it. So he jumps in here. And because we know every vowel, every syllable needs a vowel. Did I say that right? I think I might have switched that around earlier. But anyway. Every syllable has a vowel, so E steps in there just to keep peace because the U refused. There's also the schwa syllable, but we're not going to talk about that. I need to get through this a little faster. We have spelling rules. At first, it seems like there's no rhyme or reason sometimes. But there are reasons. There's probably more rules than you know. One that I find so fascinating is the CLE versus KLE. Do you know when you use CLE versus KLE when you have the cool sound? With the exception of about three words, if there is a two-syllable word, it is KLE. If it is three or more syllables, it's going to be CLE. And I tell them to remember it this way. You know, we have curriculum CLE. That's, you know, what my students are doing. Are your books hard? Yeah, they're hard. Okay, the big long words are going to be CLE. And there's three words that uncle circle, and there's one more that don't follow. Otherwise, they all follow that rule. An Orton-Gillingham program is a good source of those rules, and I often say that those Barton videos that are so boring to watch, really good teaching for first grade teachers or second, third grade teachers. So, and like I said, the etymology, the history of words, how a word comes to be. If you do some study on that, it's pretty fascinating. But yeah, there is usually a reason why there's an exception to the rule. I actually kind of don't like when I hear people say, oh, you know, there's no rules, there's no rhyme or reason. Yeah, there is. Just last week, someone was telling a story about they were coming up to something irregular or something, and one of the first graders or second graders, I think first graders said, why did God make it that way? I thought that was kind of cute. Language, you know, it changes. Fluency. Fluency happens when a word is easily recognized. I do not like to see someone skimping on fluency drills. Now, this might be your word list. This might be victory drills, this might be anything, and I know they're boring, and I know the students sometimes get so tired of practicing, but keep practicing. I do send mine home. My parents are great. Most times they do so well with helping the student go over them over and over and over. I know, you know, it's tough, but I think it's necessary. Give them a reward. That helps to, what do they say, a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down. Do what you need to do, but get that practice in. And the more you are able to practice words, the more fluently a student will read. Um, Timothy Racinski, I think is how you pronounce this. He is considered kind of the expert of reading fluency. And this is a really good book. It's got lots of ideas of things to do. He very much encourages to read a passage several times. He also talks about things like oral reading, like choral reading, role play, things like that. This book has a lot of good ideas. He also talks about singing, and I'm thinking, well, I mean, we Mennonite schools, we sing all the time. This is great. But make sure your students, at least once they can, are following along in their songbook. Also, make sure they're following along when you're saying your Bible memory. These are just things that you do every day. Go ahead and cash in on that. Get them to, you know, try to get them to look and to follow along. Ooh, I'm running out of time. Reading comprehension. You all, this is often not so much with a child who has dyslexia. Often I see that children with dyslexia, they can stumble through some of these words. Not always. But they can stumble through some of this, and they actually can tell me a lot about what they just read. And I'm like, how did you ever remember? I mean, it seemed like it took so much effort to sound out words. However, there are students that can read just so fluently, and they still have no idea what they read. I think this is, while this is the ultimate goal, it is hard without the other steps, but it does happen. That all the other steps, everything else is wonderful, and this is still a problem. A few ideas. Spend time in pre-reading activities, predicting. Afterwards, summarizing. This last year, I was having a little bit of trouble with this, and so I actually did something where I got them to read every paragraph and then summarize, close your book. Or we kept our finger in there or something. Close your book and now tell me, what did that paragraph just say? And yeah, it was time consuming, but I think it did help. Read with expression. It's really hard to read with expression without comprehending. And so when your child starts reading with expression, they have to know what's being said. Have them feel what's happening. And we have the, I don't know if any of you have ever seen the skit about the house is on fire, where they're trying to do a play and the house is on fire and they're crying, the house is on fire, the happiest house on fire. It's the wrong emotion. It's not that they don't have emotion. It's not that they don't have expression. It's the wrong expression. So, you know, get them to think about, how does this character feel? Now, convey your voice to make it the same thing. Asking questions both while you're reading and afterwards, but go ahead and stop, just in the middle, stop. And it kind of wakes up the brain, like, oh, that's right. We're supposed to be paying attention here. You can come up with your own questions. You can use questions in their books. Usually when I ask questions in their books, I don't let them write it down right away. I don't let them write the answer down. We'll talk about it, and then later they can go ahead and fill it in. In conclusion, I have a quote here that says, every year that intervention is delayed makes it harder for a student to catch up academically. I know it's tempting to think, oh, this problem will take care of itself. And sometimes it does seem to. But I think this is the reason why we say dyslexia cannot be cured, because that gap just gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And even though they come up to the others, they're never quite, never quite up there. So you as first, second, third grade teachers, find those problems and try your best to fix them now, because and I know from experience, once it gets on up there in those grades and they have to do some pretty complex work, it is really, really, really discouraging. So I have my number and email address up there. Feel free to ask me any questions. And last of all, I have a list of resources. I do have some resources over here as well. I do want to say a little bit about the Youth Life Foundation. I've been using this to help supplement my Christian Life learning tree. I am really excited. I was just in Virginia last week, and I am very excited for what Learning to Read might look like in about 5 to 8 years from now. So I think some of these things are, some of these easy ways of teaching will be for everybody here soon. So I'm excited about that. However, if you're feeling like I need something now, I found good success with using this supplement. Like I said, I use Hegarty. I'm also always looking for books, real books, that they can read, because how are they going to practice unless they can read real books? The Doc for Learning has a video, an explanation for kids. I love that video. If you have access to it, look it up. I show children who are struggling that video. I love that video. Yeah. Any other questions?